We have three presentations today. Ms. Sonia, I guess, is the first one up on the nonprofit status of hospitals. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the work group, my name is Julie Sonier, and I direct the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. I've been asked to present a summary of the January 2007 Minnesota Department of Health report to the legislature on hospital uncompensated care.
You want to just pull that a little bit closer? Thanks.
Community benefits and the value of tax exemptions for nonprofit hospitals in Minnesota. A copy of that report has been distributed to all the members of the work group. In 2006, the legislature passed a bill requiring MDH to study and report back on these issues. We were required to report on trends in hospital uncompensated care, and that includes both charity care, which is care that a hospital provided and for which they did not expect payment, bad debt, which is care that a hospital expected to be paid for but never received payment. We were also asked to look at the impact that recent changes in hospital policies regarding charity care and bad debt collection have had on uncompensated care. And finally, we were asked to estimate the value of community benefits provided by nonprofit hospitals and the value of tax exemptions that nonprofit hospitals receive. With regard to trends in uncompensated care, the most recent year for which we currently have complete data is 2005. The most recent 2 years of reporting have seen a fairly large increase in the amount of uncompensated care reported by Minnesota hospitals. So in 2004, uncompensated care increased by 18%, and it increased by an additional 26% in 2005. The total estimated cost to hospitals of providing uncompensated care was about $191 million in 2005. Just to take a minute to talk about how we calculate this figure, because there's sometimes some confusion about whether this is charges or whether it's the cost of providing care. This is actually a cost-based figure. So the total amount of charges that hospitals reported for uncompensated care in 2005 was about $415 million. And when we report on uncompensated care, we make an adjustment to charges so that it does more accurately reflect the cost of providing care. So, for example, on average across the hospital industry in Minnesota in 2005, operating expenses were about 46% of charges, and so we make that downward adjustment to the uncompensated care figures to have it more accurately reflect the cost of the care. Another way that's often used to look at trends in uncompensated care is to look at trends over time in the percentage of hospitals' operating expenses that this represents. For Minnesota hospitals, this amount rose from 1.6% in 2003 to 2% in 2005, and that is higher than it's been in recent years. But if you look at the trend over the past decade, it's within the range of historical averages. And in comparison to the national average, Minnesota hospitals have historically had much lower uncompensated care as a percentage of operating expenses. And one of the main reasons for this, of course, is that Minnesota has a lower uninsurance rate than the rest of the country. Our report also includes a fair amount of detail on how uncompensated care splits out between charity care and bad debt and how it varies across hospitals. So, for example, the slide that's up on the screen now looks at differences over time between rural and urban hospitals. Historically, uncompensated care expenses were higher for urban hospitals than rural ones, but this difference has virtually disappeared over the past several years. About 10 of Minnesota's 136 hospitals in 2005 provided over half of the industry's total uncompensated care. Hennepin County Medical Center provided the most in terms of dollars, about $33.5 million, and they also had the highest ratio of uncompensated care to operating expenses at 7.5%. Seven of the 10 largest providers of uncompensated care that are listed in this table were in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. One was in Rochester, one in Duluth, and one in St. Cloud. Among this group of 10 hospitals that provide the largest amounts of uncompensated care, there actually is substantial variation in the cost of this care as a percentage of their total cost. So they are all providing, in dollar terms, the most uncompensated care in the state. But for 7 of the hospitals in this group, their uncompensated care percentage as a share of operating costs was actually lower than the statewide average of 2% in 2005. And then just to summarize, the final slide on uncompensated care just is another way of showing how that burden of uncompensated care is distributed unevenly across hospitals. So, again, this just shows that a small number of hospitals are providing most of the uncompensated care. Hennepin County Medical Center, for example, provides nearly one-fifth of the total uncompensated care in the state. So just to summarize on the findings on uncompensated care before moving on to the community benefit issues, what we found in our study was there had been a substantial increase in the cost of uncompensated care provided by Minnesota hospitals over the most recent 2 years of data that were available to us. We do have preliminary, though incomplete, data for 2006 that suggests that this may have begun to stabilize, but it will be another couple of months before we have all of the information in. And the low uncompensated care as a share of operating expenses at hospitals has increased. It is within the range of historical averages in the state. And just as another little bit of context for what all of this means for hospitals, in terms of the industry as a whole, the financial condition appears to still be fairly strong. So in 2005, Minnesota hospitals as a group earned about $700 million in net income, which was about 6.9% of revenue.
Is that coming from a report you guys put together?
Yes, it does.
Could you send the bigger report on that when you get the data that's underlying that?
This is here.
The 6.9% is?
Is it in here?
It is not in the uncompensated care report. It is in the chart book that we publish on the web with market statistics, and we can provide that to the committee.
Oh, okay. You just send the email link or something. Thank you.
Turning to the issue of community benefits provided by nonprofit hospitals and how we went about estimating those for purposes of our study, just as a little bit of background, in order for hospitals to maintain their nonprofit status, the Internal Revenue Service requires them to provide benefits to their communities, which can actually encompass a wide range of activities. Charity care counts as community benefit, although it is not required as a condition of nonprofit status. There are many things in the IRS definition of community benefit that are not necessarily quantifiable. So, for example, operating an emergency room, having an open medical staff where all doctors in the community can practice. But the last few years have seen increasing efforts to develop standard sets of definitions for hospitals to use to quantify the amounts of community benefits that they provide. There's a set of standards developed by the Catholic Health Association, which is the most commonly used set of definitions, and this was the basis that we took in estimating community benefit for purposes of our report. We should note, however, that there are some significant disagreements about what types of things should be counted as community benefit, and the two most significant items that are excluded from the Catholic Health Association definition of community benefit that others argue should be included. The first is payment shortfalls from serving Medicare beneficiaries, and the other is bad debt. Neither of those is included in the estimates in our report. This table provides a summary of our findings on estimates of community benefit provided by Minnesota hospitals. In total, our estimate of community benefit for 2005 was about $607 million. And this includes several pieces. First, the cost of charity care was about $80 million. We also include payment shortfalls from state public insurance programs such as Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and General Assistance Medical Care. The payment shortfall of $195 million that's shown in this table is about 15% of the cost of providing care. We also include, following the CHA definitions, taxes that are used that are used as matching funds to obtain federal resources. So these include the Medicaid surcharge and the 2% Minnesota Care provider tax, which, as you can see from this table, add up to about $200 million. Also, according to the CHA standards for quantifying community benefits, we subtract payments to hospitals, public payments to hospitals that are specifically intended to offset the cost of providing charity care and serving low-income payments, and that's the Medicaid disproportionate share payments that you see in the table. So in total, we estimated that the community benefit provided by hospitals as a net of the public program payment shortfalls and taxes was about $358 million in 2005. There are other quantifiable community benefits that hospitals provide, and some examples of those are services that typically operate at a loss, such as perhaps trauma centers and burn units. Spending for activities like community health education or free clinics. In 2006, the Minnesota Hospital Association conducted a survey of its members, and we used that data in our report as well, and that's where the figure of $235 million in other quantifiable community benefits comes from. And then finally, for the reason similar to why we take out the Medicaid DSH payments from community benefit, we also subtract Medicare DSH payments to hospitals because those are specifically intended to offset their cost of caring for low-income populations. And that's how we get to our net of $607 million.
Mr. Chairman?
You can go ahead.
Senator Berlin.
I just can't let this slide pass us by without raising my concern about including the Minnesota Care tax as a community benefit, because the law specifically says that the tax is to be passed through by insurance companies to providers as a part of their payment. And so to all of a sudden turn this tax that we collect into a charitable contribution, it does seem to me like it's quite a stretch. And I think it does make a difference because it is a considerable amount of the total. And if it were not included, I think the outcome or the result, the conclusion of the report would be different. And so I do feel that it's important to point that out.
Do you have any comments?
Senator Berglund, that's a good point, and it's something that we discussed for a long time when we were trying to figure out what should be included in the calculations. And using the definitions that we had, which we believe to be the most standard in the industry, we felt that we needed to count it. I would note that in the legislation passed this year, which requires annual reporting of community benefit, Minnesota Care Tax is not one of the items that gets counted as community benefit.
Yeah.
I just have a clarifying question about, I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. So the Catholic standard excludes the Medicare shortfall, right, if I understand that correctly.
Yes, it does.
But in your case, in this case, you chose to include the Medicaid shortfall. And what is, could you just tell me if it was excluded in the Catholic standard, the Medicare shortfall, why did we include the Medicaid shortfall in ours?
Ms. Sonier.
Mr. Chair and members of the work group, there's the Catholic standard actually explicitly includes payment shortfalls from state public programs that are targeted to serving low-income beneficiaries and specifically excludes Medicare payment shortfalls because the Medicare program is not, it is a program for the elderly primarily and is not specifically targeted at low-income populations.
So it includes, so the Catholic standard includes the Medicaid shortfalls, you're saying, the state?
That's correct.
Why you include it. Okay, thanks.
Yes, Dr. Jacobs.
Just to address Senator Berglund's issue, I think if the reason to look at the community benefit numbers are to determine if the value is equivalent to what would happen if it was taxed, if these weren't nonprofit for healthcare system but taxed, then it would make sense to add that tax back in to try to get to an equivalent number. So I can understand including the Minnesota Care tax if that is what you're trying to get at the community benefit number four, to have a comparative to what would it look like in a for-profit system if we were just taxing healthcare.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Jacobs, it doesn't matter. I mean, I believe, are fortunate that we have not-for-profit hospitals in Minnesota, but if we didn't, let's say we had a mix, they all would be paying the provider tax.
Yeah, but they might or they may not. But
what do you mean they might not?
Well,
it's across the board tax.
No, but the legislature passed that into a state where we didn't have for-profit health care. It might have come to a different conclusion.
Well, no. The way tax law works, it has to be broad-based and applied evenly. So the idea wasn't to tax not-for-profits and not to tax for-profits. In fact, we have quite a few for-profit clinics in the state, and they also pay the provider tax. So.
Right, but they make up a very small percentage of that number. They tend to be small practice entities and not the big elements in the system. So that tax is heavily weighted on the nonprofits.
Well, I guess we could have an argument about that, but I don't want to waste everyone's time with that. The chiropractors and the dentists all who have, incorporated for-profit offices don't look at it that way.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I think we have one for-profit hospital. At least we did till recently. In St. Louis Park, I think.
Regency Hospital in Golden Valley.
Golden Valley. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Sonier.
Turning from the calculation of community benefits to how we estimated the value of tax exemptions for hospitals, there's some very lengthy and detailed explanation of how we did that in the appendix of the report, and I'll just summarize it briefly here. We looked separately at several different types of tax benefits, including property taxes, sales taxes, state and federal income taxes, as well as the fact a couple of other tax advantages that come from the fact that nonprofit hospitals can borrow at lower rates through the use of tax-exempt bonds, and the fact that donors to nonprofit hospitals can deduct their donations on their income tax returns. And all of those are itemized in this table. In total, we estimated that the value of tax exemptions for Minnesota hospitals was $482 million in 2005. Since the publication of this report in January, there have been two significant developments with regard to nonprofit hospitals in Minnesota. First, all nonprofit hospitals in the state voluntarily agreed to extend existing agreements with the Attorney General on providing discounts to uninsured patients and standardizing debt collection practices for a period of 5 years. The second major change, which we've mentioned already briefly, is that the legislature enacted annual reporting requirements for hospital community benefit. And these data will be incorporated into existing MDH data collection from hospitals. And the law provides a specific definition of community benefit, which includes community care, underpayments for state health care programs, research, community health services, financial and in-kind contributions, community building, the cost of community benefit operations, education, and the cost of operating subsidized services. There are two items that we included in our calculation of community benefit for this report that are not included in this definition as it was established by the legislature this year, and those are the two taxes that are used to generate federal match. So it is the Medicaid surcharge and the Minnesota Care tax are not included in the new definition of community benefit in state law. Without those two items, the estimated community benefit for 2005 would be approximately $200 million less than the amount that we included in our report. So that is the quick summary of the report, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Further questions? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sonier, when you were doing this report, you were looking at it as an aggregate of all the hospitals in the state. But based on your results, it would seem clear to me that there are some hospitals that contribute a lot more community benefit than their tax benefit would require them to break even, and other hospitals contribute much less.
Ms. Sonier.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we did include in the appendix to the report a hospital-by-hospital analysis, but one caution that I would add is that particularly on the tax benefit side, the estimates are fairly rough, and although we had more confidence in the tax benefits as a statewide aggregate, because sometimes we were using statewide data to do that, it is certainly something that does show a lot of variation across hospitals, but should at this point be considered sort of early rough estimates that would need significant refinement if there were going to be comparisons. For example, if the state were to consider requiring a certain level of community benefit from hospitals.
I wasn't meaning to pick on anybody in particular, just in general, there would be some hospitals that would be making a lot more of a contribution than others.
Okay. Mr. Benner, Pete.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the question I think addressed to what we count as care in a hospital. As integrated care systems evolve and care can be given on an inpatient basis, care can be given on an outpatient basis. Sometimes the hospital owns the outpatient facility. Sometimes somebody else owns the outpatient facility. Sometimes people lease space in an inpatient hospital to do something that is not controlled by the hospital at all. How do you get at all those confounding pieces as to what's in the pie that we're counting here?
Ms. Sonia.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Benner, that's a good question because one of the things that happens in particular with regard to community benefit activities is that hospital systems will also often do those at a system level, and then when the reporting is by hospital, it creates some complications in how to allocate those activities. And I guess what I would say is for those kinds of activities that happen at a system level, I think moving forward we need to have more conversations with the hospital association and hospitals about how to allocate those. But separately, when there's other activities, so someone leases space in a hospital to do something, say it's a physician group, if their services are not being billed by the hospital, for example, then all of that activity is outside of what we might report as uncompensated care. So literally it is services that would have been billed by the hospital and not, for example, physician groups that practice there.
Julie or one of the chairs. So now, would there then be a similar requirements on uncompensated care to healthcare organizations who are not hospitals or not integrated organizations, even though they're doing exactly the same thing? You know, Representative Huntley and I were talking briefly this morning on radiology. And if a hospital runs the radiology piece, is it under an uncompensated care obligation? But if it's not, but if it's run by a freestanding group of radiologists, they're not under an obligation?
Ms. Sonia?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Benner, just to clarify your question, if you're referring to the obligation to provide emergency care and stabilization, then hospitals are subject to that requirement and other types of facilities are not.
Okay.
State and federal law don't require the provision of charity care in other circumstances.
Only hospitals.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we believe that there is a certain amount, a certain percentage of uncompensated care in the rest of the healthcare system, but we believe the majority of it is in the hospital portion. And so we do not have a mechanism to collect exactly how much is provided by which providers in the non-hospital part of the healthcare system. We estimate how much it is, but we don't attribute it to particular providers.
Done.
Mr. Chairman, just to respond to Pete's question, too, we separate out all of our professional fees when we report that, and so that's tracked separately for a medical group fee versus a hospital in terms of uncompensated care. And then if we have a medical group that's practicing in our facility and the person doesn't have insurance, they're basically at risk for that. There is no payment to that medical group for the service. So if it's radiology in our hospital and it's an uncompensated care patient, the radiology group does not get paid for that. but they would account for that separately from our own totals. But what you're seeing here would just be reflective of inpatient charges.
Representative Huntley.
Well, maybe you can answer. So if a woman's pregnant, goes to the hospital, has the delivery there, gets a bill from the obstetrician, let's say, plus gets a bill from the hospital, then you're saying that the obstetrician's charge is not included in these numbers.
That's correct, yes. Okay. The professional component or the actual physician fee component of it is not included.
Another question.
Yeah, Representative Huntley. Ms. Sonier, Mr. Chair and Ms. Sonier, I think it's the third, it's $191 million bucks of uncompensated care. And you said uncompensated care is charity care and bad debt. And then later on one of your other tables, it's about $80 million bucks in charity care. So that means there's about 190. So the bad debt is even larger than the charity care.
Ms. Sonier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, the $191 million in uncompensated care is about $80 million in charity care and $110 million in bad debt for 2005.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you. I think you have another presentation to do, so why don't we go to that one?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I think Ms. Sonier ought to be just made a member of this committee.
She's pretty much right.
She's here more often than some of the members.
That's right. That's right. Go ahead.
Thank you. For the second part of this presentation today is that I've been asked to provide an overview of our most recent information on healthcare cost trends in Minnesota and the drivers of healthcare cost growth. And this presentation will focus primarily on the result of analysis of trends in the private health insurance market that the Health Economics Program publishes each year. There's a four-page issue brief that each of you should have a copy of, and this summarizes the analysis in that issue brief. So just quickly, overview of what the issue brief covers. It looks at trends in premium growth in the private health insurance market, also looks at what's going on with the underlying costs, which is the amount of claims that health plans pay per person in the private health insurance market, takes a look at how this compares to other economic indicators, and then looks below the surface at what types of services are driving the spending growth. The chart that's up on the screen now shows annual increases in health insurance premiums along with the annual increases in the amounts that health plans actually spend on behalf of enrollees in the private health insurance market. So the premiums per person are the blue bars on this chart, and the costs per person is actually in gray. One of the most notable things to notice about this chart is that in the mid-1990s, premiums were clearly not keeping pace with underlying spending growth, and this created a situation where health plans needed to raise premiums to recover the losses that they incurred in those years. Starting around 1998, premiums began to rise more quickly, but so did spending around that same time. So there were two forces driving premium growth then. It was higher cost increases as well as the cyclical nature and the need to recover those past losses. In 2005, premium growth was about 4.5% per person, and that was the slowest rate of growth that we had seen since 1997. In 2006, however, this rose to 7.6%. Similarly, with the growth in underlying cost, it also took an upward turn in 2006 after having slowed for each of the previous 3 years. So those are certainly issues for concern that indicate that the best indicator of what's going to happen to premiums in the near future is what is that underlying cost trend, which is currently running at nearly 9% per person per year. I talked a little bit already about the cycle of premiums, but what this chart does is it actually shows the difference over time in premiums per person collected by health plans versus their spending on behalf of enrollees. And you really can see that cycle where in the mid-1990s, the fact that premiums weren't keeping up with spending led to a number of years of losses, and the premium increases in the following years brought the plans back to a positive situation. And in 2006, premiums and underlying cost per person were actually roughly equal, with premiums just about half a percentage point above costs. And what that suggests is that with an underlying cost trend of about 9%, there really isn't much room for health plans to necessarily absorb that, because the premiums are already just about the same as costs. And so it suggests that the premium trends into the next couple years would expect around that 8 to 9% range. This next chart compares the trend in health plan spending per person to other economic indicators, and I apologize if some of the colors don't show up well, but the red line on the chart is the trend. It is the trend in the cost per person incurred by health plans for people who have private insurance. It does not include enrollees' out-of-pocket spending, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But again, starting around 1998, we see a pretty strong divergence of those trends, where healthcare cost growth was much higher than the trend in all of those other important economic indicators. The gap did seem to narrow up until 2005, and then began to grow wider again in 2006. So healthcare costs are still growing about 2 to 3 times faster than average wages and income in Minnesota, and about 5 times faster than general inflation. So far, all of the information that I presented has just been comparing premiums and the amount of claims that health plans pay on behalf of their enrollees. The chart that's up on the screen now shows the trends in health plan costs plus enrollee out of costs, and that's important because we know that one strategy that employers, for example, have used to control premium growth is to provide health plans that require more enrollee cost sharing, such as higher deductibles or co-payments. And so what this chart does is combines those two pieces to look at that trend in total costs. When we add in the amount that enrollees are paying out of their own pockets, total health care spending per person with private insurance was just over $4,000 in 2006, which was an 83% increase over 2000. And the average amounts that enrollees paid out of their own pockets more than doubled during this time, along with the share of the total bill that enrollees were paying. So in 2000, enrollees' share of the cost was about 10% of the total. In 2006, that represented about 14% of total cost. Taking that look below the surface of aggregate cost trends, we do collect information from the health plans on their spending by type of service, and that enables us to look at a fairly aggregated level at cost drivers by type of service. And there's two main factors to think about there. First is the total share of spending that's accounted for by each service to start with. So types of services like physician services and hospital services that represent a large share of spending are usually also going to represent a large share of cost growth. But the second factor that's important to look at is variation in the growth rates of spending for different services. From 2004 to 2006, the fastest growing category of services was inpatient hospital services at 11.9% per person per year. And that's shown, the growth rates of spending are shown in the blue bars on this chart, and the share of total growth that those represented are on the right-hand side in the gray bars. So inpatient hospital spending represented a little over a quarter of the total spending growth during this two-year period. Outpatient hospital services grew a little bit less rapidly, but they also account for a large share of growth because they're a high proportion of spending to start with. And finally, physician services grew by about 11% per year as well. And because they are about a third of total spending growth, they accounted for 43% of the total growth in claims per person that health plans paid during this time period. A couple of things to notice about this analysis that is different from previous years when we presented this is that prescription drug growth is nearly flat And administrative cost growth was also flat during this two-year period. All of those factors combined, the flat growth in administrative costs and drug costs and the faster growth in physician and hospital services, means that together physician and hospital services accounted for about 90% of the growth in underlying costs during that period.
Can I just have you go back to the previous slide on the administrative costs? What's included in that number?
Mr. Chair, it's health plan administrative costs, so it doesn't include provider sides. But there's a long list of about 14 different items that are health plan administrative costs. So it's everything from billing enrollment to claims payment, marketing, general overhead. We can get you a list of that if you want.
Representative Holly.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sonier, does that include the taxes they pay, including MinCare? Does that go under administration or elsewhere?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, for purposes of this analysis, the Minnesota Care Tax is included as medical spending. It is not included as administrative spending.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Sonia, do you know if they include quality initiatives in administration, or is that medical services?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, the cost of quality assurance programs is an itemized expense in administrative costs.
Can I do on the physician side or the hospital side, do we ever break out the administrative costs there as a separate category in terms of it's not obviously here, but.
Mr. Chair, right. The data that we use to do this is data from payers. We have separate sources of data from hospitals and physician clinics that help us look at that question of administrative costs there as well.
Do you know what those numbers would be? And if you don't, that's fine. But
I don't know them off the top of my head, but I do know that we have them, and we're in the process of pulling them together for the Transformation Task Force, so we will have something available shortly.
Okay, thanks. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sonier, is it possible for you to break out the physician increase so that we could tell how much is due to specialty physicians versus primary care physicians?
Sonia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, the data that we have for this is aggregated. It is just one category for physician services. There might be other sources of information, perhaps from the Medicaid program, that would allow for looking at primary care versus specialty care services. I know that MedPAC, which is the congressional agency that does this sort of analysis for the Medicare program, has done this analysis and has shown that specialty services are much more of a driver of cost than primary care services have been over the past several years.
Pete?
I think I know the answer to this, but let me check. When a health plan does disease management, that's an admin cost here, correct?
That's correct.
But if Blue Cross Blue Shield pays Duluth Clinic to do the same function, that's considered a medical cost?
Ms. Sonier.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Benner, I believe that's correct.
Okay. You're on your summary, I guess.
Yes, just to quickly summarize the results of this analysis. Health insurance premiums and underlying cost growth both increased in 2006, which was a reversal of the trend that we'd seen over the previous few years. The growth continues to be faster than growth in incomes and wages of Minnesotans, and enrollee out-of-pocket spending continues to rise at a faster rate than overall spending. All of those things combined, we think, are a concern in terms of the sustainability of current trends and the affordability of private health insurance in Minnesota. The major drivers of costs for 2004 to 2006, as they have been historically, continue to be physician and hospital services, simply because these services are a large share of total spending to begin with. And then just as a final note on the questions of can we dig deeper into the causes of cost increase, like some of the questions around primary and specialty care, the data that we use to do this analysis are very highly aggregated data from health plans, but there are sometimes other sources of data in other types of analyses that we can look at to get into those questions. But ultimately, the questions are, you know, whether costs are being driven by increases in price, increases in the quantity of services, or some combination of both, and really are being driven by factors like demographics, the health of the population, the available treatments and technology to treat those things. So with this analysis, we can't get down into those factors, but those certainly are the underlying issues that one would want to look at in addressing overall cost growth.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman, and another response for Mr. Benner. I think Health Partners said that if they do disease management, that shows up in their administrative costs, but they're unusual in that they're an insurance company and a delivery system at the same time.
Ms. Zimmer?
Yes, that would be correct. If we're bearing the costs of the case managers are employed by the health plan, that would show up in health plan administrative costs, which have been flat or declining. So the efficiencies are made up in other places.
Further questions? Pete?
Just anecdote and question. As I'm driving home last night from the meeting of the Senator Olson Representative Loeffler Working Group, and picked up the Taco Bell, and I'm driving up Wentworth in West St. Paul, and right across from the library there is some outfit that and its sign is wanted, medical debt collectors. So apparently there's a growth industry in medical of the debt collectors. Now, so my question is, as you collect overall data, are you able to collect data on aggregate medical debt owed by Minnesota families, as opposed to bad debt that's already been written off, I guess, by providers?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benner, we don't currently collect that type of information, and I'm not aware of anyone who does collect it.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benner, but we do know that health care costs are the largest reason for filing bankruptcy in the United States. So, you know, until home foreclosures or something else becomes the major reason, we know that we have a lot of medical debt out there. It's accumulating.
And we just had some hearings outside of the Twin Cities that looked at the rural at farmers and ranchers, and in the study that study showed, about a quarter of them have spent into medical debt in the time that the study was ongoing. So that gives another sense of that. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to have one more presentation and then kind of give a sense of where we see the next couple of weeks headed here. So, some of the presentations we have today, I think, will feed into that discussion, just so you have a little context on where we're headed. Who's
Matt Moss.
Matt. Oh, hi. How are you?
While he goes up to the podium, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to note two handouts that are in your packets. One was information, I think, that was requested at one of our earlier meetings about asset limits in our public programs. And so there's a handout on that. And then there is an article about the funding method that is being used in Maine being upheld by the Supreme Court.
Okay. Mr. Mossman.
Hi, members. My name is Matt Mossman. I'm the lead fiscal analyst with the Senate, and I'm sitting in today for David Godfrey, the fiscal analyst for the Health and Human Services Committee, who is out for a few weeks with us. And I will point out you have a memo in your handouts or packet, I think, that I'm actually just going to stick pretty close to. And the report here, presentation, is just getting back on a question about the state loan forgiveness program and the potential for that program to be replaced instead with a system that would draw on medical assistance benefits as well as state resources to provide for loan forgiveness or provide support for loan forgiveness. Currently, the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program is administered by the Department of Health. The program provides benefits to six different groups of eligible recipients: physicians who commit to practice in rural or underserved areas, pharmacists are identified in statute as a separate category, as are mid-level providers, which is physician's assistants, nurse anesthetists, and others. Nurses who commit to practice in nursing homes or intermediate care facilities, and dentists who commit to a substantial number, I believe the statute refers to 25% of yearly patient contacts, of program and sliding fee patient recipients, and nursing and allied health providers. And the program for individuals then who serve in these, practice in these underserved areas and commit to provide the services to the at the levels referred to in statute, then are eligible for loan forgiveness up to 4 years. The current annual budget for the program is $1.295 million. It comes from several sources in the state budget. $155,000 of it comes from the state general fund. $400,000 of it comes from the state government special revenue fund, which is generally speaking a fund that is a fee-supported activities, and $740,000 comes from the healthcare access fund. I would note that the SGSR appropriation is scheduled to sunset at the end of fiscal year 2011. With regard to whether or not the medical assistance reimbursement could be used as an alternative to the loan forgiveness program, it is possible that enhanced MA reimbursement to providers could be used to meet who meet the criteria for the loan forgiveness program could be used. Eligible providers would need to apply with the Department of Human Services to receive a rate increase, and the rate increase would be in effect for a limited time period. The program would draw a dollar-for-dollar match from the federal government, and the match could then double as the amount available for the appropriation, thereby either making more money available or freeing up funds for this activity. That is, in concept, how such a program could work. Apparently, upon asking some questions with the Department of Human Services and having them look at this, the department's take is that the Department of Human Services stated that such a reimbursement program would need to be carefully structured to ensure that it is in compliance with federal Medicaid rules. Recently, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services promulgated rules which severely restrict the use of Medicaid reimbursement for medical education expenses. The new rules would prohibit any reimbursement rate increase for the purposes of loan forgiveness. However, it would be possible to provide a nonspecific rate increase to providers who meet the criteria for the current loan forgiveness program. For instance, the state could provide a higher medical assistance rate to physicians who choose to begin a practice in an underserved area, whether or not they are recent medical school graduates. If the state wanted to be more targeted, it could limit the rate increase to recent graduates who are 1 to 4 years out of medical school, for example. The key point in terms of federal compliance is that the additional payment is not for a specific medical education purpose. That's what would be prohibited under the rules that have been promulgated. And my understanding is that those rules are currently scheduled to go into place in May. They're currently on hold by an act of Congress. But that is what has been promulgated. Other federal compliance requirements to consider would include that the state could not require the provider to spend the money for any specific purpose. Medical assistance payments cannot be greater than the Medicaid's fair share of the provider costs. In some cases, such as hospitals, payments could not exceed the provider's upper payment limit. And the payments would have to have a statewide application, meaning that if someone meets the criteria, they would be eligible to receive the increased reimbursement. So that kind of speaks to the question of the extent to which the medical assistance approach could be tailored to meet the exact same pool of people that might be now being served through the loan forgiveness program. A couple of other notes. DHS suggested that because of the statewide application requirement, it would be difficult for the state to manage the program with a limited appropriation. The department's preference would rather be that the program would be would more likely be able to be identified as meeting a statewide application if it were a forecasted appropriation, since eligible providers would then not have to forego the rate increase if the appropriated money had been spent. Right now, the demand for the program, the loan forgiveness program, far out exceeds the appropriation, and so there's a proration that goes on within the program to allocate the available resources. The department also stated that while there may be some administrative issues with creating an application process for eligible providers, it doesn't appear at this point that it would be overly burdensome. It should also be noted that some providers currently eligible for the Department of Health Loan Forgiveness Program, the current program, would not be easily reimbursed through Medicaid rates, such as nurse educators, for example. For these providers, continuing a limited grant program through the Department of Health would be a more viable option. So that is the information, much of which was not collected by me. I'd be happy to answer or collect any questions that you have and work with the departments to get some information.
I was just wondering, did you say that the state government special revenue fund was fee supported?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, license
fees. Okay.
License fees.
So just to answer the question about why that appropriation ends in fiscal year 2011 is because we were not sure if the special revenue funds would have surpluses in them to continue to support a medical education program or not. So we would be looking at it again in the future to see if the resources were there to support this activity. And the other thing I wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, was this is just a small idea. You will remember when we had the presentation about the medical home concept, one of the barriers was, do you have enough primary care physicians in all parts of the state where you would need them? And so this was an idea perhaps to generate some additional revenues that could be targeted at that problem, perhaps.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and probably Madam Chair as well, the special revenue fund, didn't the dentist do something that actually asked us to take some money out of their license?
Well, there
fees?
Were, at the time that it was done, the pharmacists very badly wanted to be added to the program.
Okay.
And they did have some excess revenues. And so they agreed that we should do that. The nurses also had some excess revenues when we did the nurse educator program, which you don't get nurses without nurse educators, and right now it's much more lucrative to go into nursing than it is to go into nurse education. So those were then two pots, and the physicians also had excess revenues, and so some of the money was swapped out of what they were getting from the general fund to help fill in gaps in some of these other areas. So I think everyone involved understood when we did it, the need to do it.
Has the demand been essentially equal for all five groups? I know you said it exceeded the amount allotted, but is that spread out, or have some groups been more likely to participate than others?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head.
Okay.
I think that we could probably get that from the department fairly easily.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would be interested in your comments how this would work, given that much of the Medicaid and Minnesota Care business in the state is administered through contracts between DHS and then the health plans, who in turn contract with the providers. So how would this intersect or overlay those arrangements?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I understand the question, but I don't I don't have an answer, and it might be someone from DHS. I think that there would be a lot of details that would have to be worked out. There's no question, so I don't know the answer to your question, and there may be someone here from the department that could speak to that more specifically.
Mr. Schoenbaum, do you have any comments on this? And just introduce yourself, if you could, for our record. And for members, I suppose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Martin Schoenbaum from the Health Department. In answer to the question about is there a variance in the demand, the answer is yes. There's the greatest demand from nurses who are seeking support to work in nursing homes and from pharmacists who are seeking support to work in rural areas. And a couple other quick comments, if I might.
Go ahead.
Just I think from the department standpoint, we're always interested in discussing innovative approaches to financing, including financing the loan forgiveness program. And I did do a quick inquiry this morning among my peers around the country when I learned the topic this afternoon. I had an early message back that the state of Vermont is apparently somehow funding what a traditional loan forgiveness program under an 1115 waiver. I don't have any details on that yet, but we'll certainly be seeking those out. Just a couple of first reactions to the concept here.
And just so members know, I mean, within the Department of Health, you want to identify?
Sure. Excuse me. Again, I'm the director of the Department's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Among our responsibilities is administration of the loan forgiveness program for both rural and urban and the other high-need sites that are targeted by the loan forgiveness program. I think Senator Berglund's point about needing incentives to get people where it's needed is greatest, this one that we certainly share wholeheartedly. We've done evaluations of the loan forgiveness program over the years, and those evaluations confirm that it is a strong incentive. It reaches students when they're making their early career choices, when they're looking for a job, provides them a guaranteed significant lump sum payment to address something that's on their mind, their student loans, which we all hear about. And it also obligates them for a fixed period of time, at least 3 years. And if they leave early, they have to repay all the funds they need. So that's a significant part of the incentive as the current program is structured. It's not clear how you'd accomplish this through the idea that was just presented. So those are just kind of a smaller incentive over time, no ironclad commitments.
Oh, no.
Senator Bruce.
Mr. Chairman, the idea would be that the commitment would be made. But if you're running the money through the Department of Human Services, it would be made to them.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I think that's great to hear. That's an important feature that we have
right
in the current program. Again, I think the lump sum directed at student loans is another important feature. So, again, very interesting idea, you know, what he's talking about. Just some first quick reaction.
And, Mr. Chairman, in response to the earlier question, the legislature has appropriated rate increases for various things over the years, and we run them through the health plan. Sometimes we tell the health plans they have to pass it through, and sometimes we don't. So I think with the mental health increase that we recently gave, we required that it be passed through to the provider. So I think it still could be administered through health plans. Because we administer rate increases now through health plans for various provider groups.
Certainly it could if it were. I think it would be very difficult if it were done on a targeted basis to a selected set of physicians and providers who needed help with their educational expenses. If it was a general increase in a rural area, I think that could be done. But the administration of could be very difficult, at least from my knowledge of that.
Well, it could be done. I mean, it is possible that the department could administer it on a fee-for-service basis, too, for that component.
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say the federal government and we already allow certain rural hospitals charge more. I think we allow FQHCs to get reimbursed at higher rates. But I agree with you. If it's an individual physician in a place, that then it gets a little more difficult.
Further discussion? Okay. Thank you very much. Just to briefly talk and have a discussion here about where we want to head, one starting point is that we haven't still gotten fiscal information back from fiscal notes, basically back from DHS on some of the affordability discussion we've been wanting to have. And that's probably an important component of that discussion because there clearly will be a public expenditure with regard to that. But going forward, that's one of the items that we need to kind of get our hands around and make a recommendation on, and hopefully in the shorter term. A second piece that going forward is this notion of recapturing some of the savings from proposals that are out there. And for similar reasons, we haven't gotten yet back fiscal estimates for any of the cost containment proposals that are coming out of some of the other working groups. So we really don't know what the numbers are going to be specifically with regard to those. But I think we've had a little bit of a discussion, and we need to move forward on that. So the proposal would be to put out a list in the next day or two, I guess, of potential ideas more generally for recapturing savings in the system. And what that means would be some way to raise money to pay for an affordability standard, because clearly I think everybody, I don't think there's any doubt that to make health care affordable, to make health insurance affordable, there's going to have to be additional public investment. We're not going to get there all the way through savings. Or we can save the money and recapture that to spend to make health care affordable. So the notion here is that we send out some of these ideas for everybody to think about in advance and do two things. One, come to the next meeting ready to discuss some of those ideas. And the other thing is to, if you have any ideas yourself that are not on the list, this is just kind of an initial list, to email that or kind of send back ideas or reactions electronically, and we can then have a discussion going forward. Examples of what this could be, just so people can kind of get this in their head, would be, we had presentations on what Maine has done with regard to recapturing some of their savings through their program. So that's the kind of things that we're thinking about. How do we find money either through savings or perhaps through a different revenue source, I suppose, is another alternative, to pay for getting to where we want to be in our affordability scale? So that's another item of discussion that we want to move forward here. And I'll let Senator Berglund comment on all this in just a minute. Why don't we have a discussion of that for now? Senator Berglund, do you want to add to that piece of it?
Not really. I mean, originally we thought we would get fiscal notes and we would have some idea or some ballpark ideas of what the range of savings are that we'd be talking about. And it's become more clear to us now that that's not going to happen in a timely enough fashion. And so the idea was that we could talk about ways to recapture savings without knowing exactly how much we're going to recapture. And or ways to generate revenues that might be needed either for one-time investments or for ongoing investments. And both on the affordability side and on kind of priming the pump, I mean, if we're going to move to more people having medical homes, well, there might be an upfront cost to that because you might need to be investing money in the case management fee that you would be giving to a provider before you actually see the results of that provider having delivered more benefits to the healthcare system and the individual. So that was the idea, to try and at least get us moving on that discussion we've been holding back, because we thought we would get fiscal notes in a quicker manner than we're getting them.
And I think that the because we don't know exactly what the number is going to be that we have to get to, part of this process will be exploring that is and seeing what seems to work and what's not. Another thing will probably be putting priorities on different items so we can move toward a set of recommendations. What makes the most sense, and then if we have to raise additional money, what are some other alternatives, or find additional money? In terms of the larger program here, and reporting back to the Healthcare Access Commission, we did have a goal of doing that by, well, today, I guess, putting recommendations together. Obviously, that's not moving forward. So it'll probably be the next 2 weeks that we'll be focusing on, where we'll continue to meet with a goal of getting some recommendations done by within that kind of a time frame.
And we're still hopeful that during that time period we might get the fiscal notes back on the various levels of cost sharing.
Is there anything else that people think that the work group needs to spend some time on, or more information that we need to get to make fulfill our goals and make recommendations? Fulfill our charge is maybe more appropriate. Okay. No one wants to do more work. That's good. All right. Any other discussion? Pete.
Mr. Chairman, are we looking at 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours for the? I assume these will be one p.m. till sometime before dinner. The next two meetings.
I would imagine yes. So
okay.
Till 4:30.
I
would think that we're going to need some more time to and it'll be more, it'll be more interactive and kind of discussing through some of these things. So, yes, I would. For planning purposes, I wouldn't plan anything in late afternoon. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Do you have anything else, Senator Berger? Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We're adjourned.